The views expressed on this podcast may not represent those of March of Dimes or its staff. Information presented on this podcast is not medical advice and should not be construed as such. When in doubt, seek competent medical advice. Now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to Modcast, a new research podcast from the March of Dimes. Modcast is a podcast on the most impactful maternal and neonatal health research conducted today. I'm your host, Olesya Plahi.
And the 2024 March of Dimes prize goes to, drumroll please, Dr. Marisa Bartolome, who is here with me today. Hi, Dr. Bartolome.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
Great. Great. Thank you.
Today, you are a co-director of the Epigenetics Institute at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and the Perelman Professor of Cell and Developmental Biology. But 34 years ago, you were a young, hungry, and curious scientist living in New Jersey and attending Princeton University as a postdoctoral student. One evening in 1990, you made a stunning discovery. You discovered that a human gene called H19 was not a traditional gene at all. It was an imprinted gene and only the third one ever named. Dr. Bartolome was beside herself. Had she just discovered an imprinted gene? A gene that was not like other traditional genes, of which each of us have about 25,000? No, this one was different. Unlike the other genes in our body, which are meant to express each of its two copies, imprinted genes are only meant to express one of their two copies, either the maternal or paternal copy. And these strange little genes are not a dime a dozen. To date, there have only been a few hundred discovered, and it's unlikely there are going to be many more. Since that day in 1990, a lot has happened for Dr. Bartolome, and you guessed it, it's revolved around imprinted genes, a complex and largely uncharted field of genetics that she has bravely led. It turns out, and much of this is due to Dr. Bartolome's credit, that when imprinted genes suffer from mutation, they malfunction and express neither or both of their copies, leading to tragic developmental diseases for babies in utero. Dr. Bartolome's work has been indispensable. Not only has it helped the scientific community understand the importance of properly functioning imprinted genes on healthy pregnancy and development, but it has helped lead to new screening tests for developmental diseases. All this and more is why this past January, Dr. Bartolome won the 2024 March of Dimes Richard B. Johnson Jr. MD Prize, one of science's biggest lifetime achievement awards that honors an outstanding researcher who has advanced understanding of pregnancy, birth, and prenatal development. And we are thrilled to pick her brain today. Dr. Bartolome, thank you for your patience during that long but necessary introduction, and congratulations on this award.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's very much an honor.
Well, you physically received this award in March at the 2024 annual meeting of the Society for Reproductive Investigation in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. How was that?
It was wonderful. Very amazing. Thank you.
Well, take us back to that day in 1990 at your Princeton University dorm room or laboratory. Tell us where you were exactly. And why did you suspect this gene was imprinted? And why did you care that it might be imprinted? What was going on?
So we had been studying H19, and it had some really unusual properties that led us to think maybe it was imprinted. It seemed that there was a dosage, something with dosage that was, if we had too much, it was lethal to mice. And so we thought we would just try and check. So we designed this molecular assay that used molecularly distinct strains of mice set up this analysis, and I spent all day working on it in the lab at Princeton. And I ran a gel, and I, back in the old days where we put it, used radioactivity, and we put it on film, put it in a freezer. And I was like, I could go home and look at it tomorrow, but I was like, I'm not going home. So I sat there and just waited. And then, you know, some point in the middle of the night, I went and developed the film. And I was so excited. I can't even begin to tell you how excited it was, because at that point, we knew there were likely to be imprinted genes, but none had really been identified. People were searching, but this was really one of, you know, three were identified all at the same time, and this was one of them.
I've read in the past that you've said that this gene was active at high levels during embryonic and fetal development, and you just mentioned that overexpression of the gene was lethal in mice. So what were you thinking this could mean for the development of babies and this gene?
Well, we knew it was really highly expressed. And when there are very highly expressed genes, you think, well, they're going to be important for development. And the fact that you could make a mouse that had a little bit more and it was lethal, that suggested to us that its precise control was really critical for development. It was just hypothesis. We didn't really have evidence at that point, but that's what we were thinking. And that's why we went down this path to determine whether it was imprinted.
And so at the beginning of this podcast, I explained what imprinted genes were after you explained to me what they were. But can you take us through it in your own words? How do they work exactly? And maybe you could just clarify to everyone listening that these are totally normal genes. They're rare, but they're not abnormal. And that functioning normally, they actually serve, they kind of actually behave differently than the rest of our genes.
Right. So as you said, these genes have a normal biological function. They function in growth, energy regulation, very important placental function for transmitting nutrients from the mother to the fetus. And so they absolutely have very normal functions gestationally, but they're just expressed from a single allele. They're expressed either from the chromosome you inherit from your mother or the chromosome you inherit from your father. And we now know that they're sort of marked with their parental origin in the germline, so that only one of these alleles is expressed. And this marking is what's key, because once they're marked, when those alleles come into a fertilized embryo, the regulatory machinery, the transcriptional machinery knows, oh, that's maternal, express it, that's paternal, repress it, or vice versa. So this marking is what's key for governing the imprinted expression.
And so when things go wrong, does it have to do with the marking?
Yes, I mean, it absolutely has to do with the marking. As we can go into, methylation, DNA methylation, is really important for conferring this allele-specific expression, this differential marking in the germline. And so that if you don't have proper marking, if you don't have maintenance of the right DNA methylation, you can absolutely have errors. And that's really the source of a lot of human imprinting disorders.
Yes, and you are the one that discovered that about the methylation. And I thought that was the most fascinating thing that I learned from this topic from you. And we will absolutely talk about that later in the podcast. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about what the purpose of these genes is evolutionarily. And I know that maybe we don't know 100% right now, but you just wonder what, you know, if the majority of our 25,000 genes are expressing both copies, why do these ones even exist? What is their purpose?
So I'll just say, just to start by saying, there are a number of different ideas. And one of the things we know for certain is the fact they're imprinted genes requires both maternal and paternal contributions to normal development. So that's absolutely a consequence of imprinting. And also that dosage is important. But one of the first theories of imprinting that were proposed was called the kinship or the parental conflict theory, and that's where maternally expressed genes have a different interest or role than the paternally expressed genes. And one of the best sets of examples of this are the insulin growth factor 2 gene, which promotes growth, and the receptor for this gene, which actually opposes its function. And that would be considered sort of an anti-growth factor. So the paternally expressed, the IGF-2 is a paternally expressed gene, and IGF-2R, the receptor, is a maternally expressed gene. So according to this theory, where the goal of individuals is to propagate their gene pool, males don't ever know when they'll have an opportunity to breed, so they want their offspring to be strong and robust, often at the expense of the pregnant mothers. So paternally expressed genes are more likely to be growth factors. In contrast, the female attempts to preserve her reproductive longevity with smaller offspring that are viable. And so her maternally imprinted genes are usually growth regulators. And that's sort of been the most remarkable of the imprinting theories. But again, as I said, a lot of this is still unclear. It's hard to prove evolution at this point.
We know what imprinted genes and how they ought to behave, which is the expression of just one of their alleles. But sometimes things do go awry, and epigenetic mutations do happen. And we talked earlier about how a lack of a marking caused by changes in methylation or abnormal methylation is responsible for that. Let's talk very quickly about epigenetics, because this has been a buzzword in science for probably at least a decade, I'm sure much longer in your spaces, but I think in the popular consciousness, probably for about 5 to 10 years. What do we mean when we talk about epigenetics?
So epigenetics refers to the marking of the DNA that doesn't change the DNA, and it's reversible. And it usually happens by chemically modifying a base or chemically modifying the way the DNA is packaged. And so that then affects the regulation potential of the genome, of a given gene. And that's what we call epigenetics. It can be DNA methylation, it can be chromatin modifications, et cetera.
So this is the way that genes are expressed, correct?
Right, correct.
And is epigenetic the same as epigenetic mutation the same as genetic mutation?
So a genetic mutation would involve an actual change to the base.
Okay.
Whereas an epigenetic mutation is considered something above the DNA sequence. So the DNA sequence is altered by a genetic mutation, but it isn't altered with an epigenetic mutation.
Understood. Okay. I just want to say something that that I'm thinking right now, which is that genetics is very complicated. You know, sometimes you think, oh, genetics, you know, you get a copy from the mom, a copy from the dad, 23andMe, et cetera. It's super complicated because you've got the sequence, then you've got alleles, then, you know, you've got epigenetics, you've got mutations. I think it's very complicated. So hats off to you. And not only that, but you're in a very difficult area, which is imprinted gene mutation. So I would say that certainly it's a doozy, Marisa. It's a doozy.
It is. And I should also add that sometimes an epigenetic mutation can be triggered by a genetic mutation. And so that can add a layer of complexity onto it. Sometimes it's part of the epigenetic machinery. And so the phenotype, sort of how the disease presents itself, is a result of what the changes in the epigenetics. But sometimes it can be a cis little deletion that affects the DNA methylation. So it is very complicated, but we're working it out. So that's great.
Yeah, and certainly you are working it out. And as I mentioned earlier, you one of the big reasons that you were honored with this award and one of the biggest victories of your career was figuring out the reason for these imprinted gene mutations. And that is because of DNA methylation, which we talked about. So what is DNA methylation?
So DNA methylation occurs when the cytosine, one of the four bases of the genetic code, is modified by a methyl group in one of its positions. And that usually occurs in the context of the CG dinucleotides. So this modification of the cytosine can lead to a change in its properties. It can be packaged differently, expressed differently, has DNA, different DNA binding modifications, but also it can be used to sort of mark the parental identities, and it is stable. It can be stably inherited. And when you have epigenetic mutations in DNA methylation, it can mean that somehow the DNA methylation state is changed, it loses it. There are a lot of different ways that can happen. And so it is a really important part of the genome that's used to regulate genes. It's used for genome stability, very, very important part of mammalian human gene regulation.
You called it a biochemical process that happens in our cells, right? In our DNA. And it's happening all the time and it's regulated beautifully. But when there is, and this is the key, you said that most cases of mutations, imprinted gene disorder, mutations, deleted disorders, are caused by too little methylation, right? Not enough of it.
Right. That's correct. There'll be something that happens that causes the methylation level to decrease.
And so your work has shed light on exactly on some of the things that causes this decrease in methylation. And many of the causes of not enough methylation are environmental, right? These are exposures to toxins like air pollution or BPA, lead, dioxins. Can you tell us about that research?
Although there's not definitive proof, in many cases, we hypothesize that there's an abnormal gestational environment that causes these methylation phenotypes. So maybe it can be nutrient levels are off, there could be genomic stress, or something that causes a failure in the machinery that maintains the epigenetic state, maintains the ability to preserve DNA methylation when the cell are dividing, because that's really important. Epigenetics requires that this DNA methylation is maintained, and we postulate that stress causes defects in the maintenance.
And so what causes the stress?
So the stress could be just having abnormal nutrients or oxygen levels or something like that that would change the expression levels of key proteins that could cause the cell to have a defect in its energy metabolism, which there are important, donors that contribute to the methylation maintenance. And so if you have defects in sort of that energy homeostasis in a cell, that can result in, for example, losses of DNA methylation.
And what about environmental toxins? Can that also cause stress, like air pollution, lead, dioxins, BPA? Can that lead to genetic stress that causes changes in methylation?
So we do know that if we take animal models and we subject them to these environmental exposures, air pollutions, BPA, that we will see DNA methylation changes. Mm-hmm. One of the problems is we don't know exactly when or how that occurs. Does it occur through the example of BPA? It's an estrogen mimic. Does it occur through an estrogenic pathway? Those are all kinds of things that lots and lots of people are studying, because obviously we want to know the mechanism by which this occurs so that we can come up with therapeutic approaches. We can protect people from these.
Okay, so we know that it's happening. We don't know exactly how it's happening. And so what about a woman that is pregnant, right? Because we've been talking about the link between these imprinted gene disorders and problems in fetal development, developmental diseases, which happen while a baby is in utero and the mother is carrying. So are we talking about a mother who is exposed to environmental pollution having these problems then, and her baby having them?
Absolutely, because during gestation, and even before the female becomes pregnant, when she's recruiting cohorts of eggs in order to become pregnant to have fertilization event, that embryo is undergoing a lot of genome-wide reprogramming. DNA methylation levels are changing. There's a lot that's happening. And the question is whether these exposures are creating an environment where the reprogramming doesn't happen perfectly. And so we think that moms could potentially, having these exposures, could have some little errors in the reprogramming, and lots of little tiny errors could eventually lead to problems later in life. But it's also important to know that males, there's evidence that males have the same problem, that they have to be careful too with these environmental exposures, because that could modify sperm, which can also contribute to problems for the baby.
That's good to know, because oftentimes, so much of the burden and the onus falls onto the mother. So certainly not good news that this can happen to both the, maternally and paternally, but important to know. So speaking of both the mother and the father coming to make this embryo that could potentially be affected, could the exposure to both mother and father happen, very soon around the time when the embryo is made, or during pregnancy for the mother? Or are we talking about a lifetime cumulative effect of exposures? Like, say the father is working in a very a coal plant or something like this.
Yes.
When does the negative effect have to take place in order for the negative result in the fetus?
I think that there's evidence that it can occur almost any time. And so obviously a pregnant mom is most susceptible to environmental exposures,
mm-hmm.
but it is very possible that, as you say, for a male working in some sort of situation where there's a lot of toxins produced, that can go in and can affect his germline. As women who also have their cohort of eggs, they're going to have their entire life, that can also affect it. So there are lots of cumulative opportunities out there to cause problems. And that's why learning how these toxicants work and learning how to get rid of them and mitigate these is really important for future health of the baby.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the disorders themselves. And again, these happen when imprinted genes, normal genes inside our bodies, suffer from a mutation, most often caused by methylation to little methylation, and express either both or none of their copies. And this leads to developmental errors in the embryo and the resulting fetus. Your work was vital to making connections between two imprinted genes, H19, which you discovered, and IGF2, those and a pair of developmental disorders affecting babies in the womb. This pair of disorders is, number one, Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, and that causes babies to grow too big in the womb and predisposes them to cancer, and Silver-Russell syndrome, which causes babies to grow too slowly in utero. Dr. Bartolomei, how common are these two syndromes, and are both of them fatal?
So these syndromes are considered orphan disease. They can be considered sort of rare. Beckwith's is approximately 1 in 10,000, with Silver-Russell being more rare. And because they're syndromes and they involve multiple genes, they have a range of phenotypes, a range of severities. Very rarely, Beckwith's can be lethal, but in most cases, these syndromes, the babies are born and they have a variety of adverse phenotypes, but if they can survive that sort of early development, they can do well with these two growth disorders. Yes.
Okay, so that is good news, but they are both quite rare. Are there other disorders that are also closely associated with imprinted genes, mutations?
Yes, there's a few others, notably Prader-Willi syndrome and Angelman syndrome. They are also rare, but these particular disorders have a lot more severe phenotypes associated with them.
It's good news that these disorders are very rare, but the environmental toxins that we've been talking about are super common, and we are exposed to them every day, obviously some people more extensively than others. And I'm sure that, you know, genetic stress is also pretty common. Is there a reason why there aren't more imprinted gene disorders?
Oh, that's a great question. Some people would argue that some of these are a little bit more common than we give them credit for, but that they're misdiagnosed. So I don't know why they're not more common. There are lots of growth disorders clinically, and so maybe there are aspects of imprinting that are involved in those. But generally speaking, they still are considered pretty rare.
And you're pretty passionate about that, the fact that some of these are going undiagnosed or misdiagnosed, right?
Yes. I've been to some meetings, especially for Angelman syndrome meeting, for example, where people never knew that their son or daughter had Angelman until they were in their 30s. So they can be misdiagnosed. This is true.
Now, the other thing I found fascinating was that your lab found that an imperfect IVF, or in vitro fertilization, embryo culture, and this is the liquid environment that embryos are created in inside a laboratory, the so-called petri dish, the liquid inside the petri dish, is linked with gene imprinting defects and disease. This was surprising to me. Can you tell us why?
So this is a really, really interesting story that a number of years ago at a meeting, people were discussing imprinting disorders, and it was sort of stated that a few of the patients were conceived through IVF. And it was something that we started to think about a little bit more, because we had been doing culturing embryos in vitro just to study them and had seen there was a loss of methylation. And so we started to look at this in more detail. And to make sort of a really long story short, with respect to Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome, there have been studies that show that IVF is associated with an about tenfold increase in the incidence. So instead of 1 in 10,000, it can be up to 1 in 900 children that are conceived that have Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome.
Wow.
So why do we think this is going on? Well,
yeah.
The embryo, the IVF occurs early in development when there's a lot of reprogramming that goes on. And we think that the embryo culture, with increased light, not being in the oviductal environment, whatever nutrients are provided by that, whatever oxygen is provided by that, all of that could be putting a stress on the DNA methylation maintenance machinery, because these IVF Beckwiths, and there's been a few cases with Angelman, show loss of methylation in key regions, and that's the cause of these imprinting disorders. And so we're looking at this, we're trying to understand what's really happening, with the ultimate goal to make it better, make it safer. And I think we're in a good place to do that.
Yeah, because inside the uterus at the time of fertilization and the days afterwards, when this embryo, when the cells multiply, et cetera, and the reprogramming happens in the uterus, there's a very distinct environment, right? The oxygen has to be just so.
Absolutely.
The temperature has to be just so. And that's not being replicated exactly in the petri dish. And so it's maybe some of those imperfections.
Yes. And light, there's no light. And it's been shown that even by pipetting embryos, which you have to do to move them around, that can elicit a stress response. And stress proteins. And so when the embryo is stressed, it may shut down some of its machinery. So there's lots of possibilities. And again, we just need to make it better so that we can eliminate any kind of syndrome that's associated with IVF.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I was also just thinking about another question, which is these four disorders that we've been talking about, these imprinted gene disorders, are they all four a result of overexpression or underexpression? So is this two copies are being expressed or no copies are being expressed, or are they all different?
So they're all different. So, for example, if you Beckwith-Wiedemann and Silver-Russell can be caused by H19 and IGF-2. Beckwith's is an overgrowth disorder, and so one way to guess that is to have too much expression of this growth factor, IGF-2. Silver-Russell is undergrowth, and so if you have loss of IGF-2, you get undergrowth. So it depends on the syndrome. Yeah.
And so, can you just explain the relationship between H19 and IGF-2? So, both of them are imprinted genes, correct?
And they're located right next to each other in the genome, and both mouse and human, and their imprinting is intimately connected to each other. In fact, we know they share regulatory regions.
Okay.
So on the maternal chromosome, only H19 is expressed, and on the paternal chromosome, IGF-2 is expressed. And if you mess up the relationship between the two genes, if you have mutations, epimutations, even deletions, and occasionally there are deletions, that can change the expression of both of these particular genes. They're not, by the way, they're not the only cause of Silver-Russell and Beckwith's. There are other imprinted loci that are involved in those syndromes, but we have studied H19 and IGF-2 most closely.
How is your work changing care? Are there folks that are working on developing new screening tests, therapeutics, interventions to maybe help those who could be at risk at getting these disorders, or that have them already, babies born with some of these syndromes? What is the status of that now?
Yeah, so I think when we first started working on, for example, H19 and IGF-2, and we didn't really know that they were involved with Beckwith's and Silver-Russell, some of our animal models showed overgrowth and undergrowth phenotypes and sort of led to people testing in their patients whether these genes were misregulated in these disorders. So and so it led to screening to look for mutations in that region. And furthermore, we found that small mutations could also result in DNA methylation defects. And that led to DNA methylation screening for these individuals. But I think that the more that we've learned about how imprinting works and how imprinted genes are controlled, it gives us more strategies for addressing therapeutics. So, for example, if you know the pathways, then you can then say, okay, let's address it by giving chemicals or drugs that would activate a gene or repress a gene. But even more interesting, and I think this is really truly exciting, is that there's a line of work in which which a lot of investigators are looking at reactivating the inactive allele. So, for example, in Angelman syndrome, UBE3A may have some mutations in it, genetic mutations that cause it to be defective. But in a given cell, there's this copy of UBE3A that's lying there quiescent. That is normal if it could be activated. And so there's a whole line of inquiry into reactivating these silenced alleles. It's lots of groups are working on it. It's a complex disorder, but I am very excited about the prospects of some of the lines of research and the therapeutics and the possibilities to help these individuals with these imprinting disorders.
So, in the case of that one disorder and activating the quiet allele, does that essentially mean turning an imprinted gene into a quote unquote traditional gene?
It does mean that. It absolutely means that. And so, as long as we know that we're not activating the whole repertoire of imprinted genes, or maybe it's only important that they're imprinted early in development, maybe later on in adults, it isn't as important. A lot of these imprinted genes have developmental roles. And so maybe, for example, with UBE3A, it's fine that it would be expressed from both alleles later on in development. And so these are kinds of experiments that people are doing them in mouse models, non-human primates, and with the goal of introducing these to in clinically. So.
Wow. Wow, that is fascinating. Well, I wonder what imprinted genes we'll have to say about that. We're going to get rid of them. One day they're going to be all gone.
That's right. That's right.
Well, this is such important work, Dr. Bartolome. It's been a pleasure having you on. Congratulations again on your award. And please come back soon to tell us more about imprinted gene disorders and potentially the disappearance of all imprinted genes.
All right. Thank you so much. This has been really fun to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us today on Modcast. We want to thank you for your support, attention, and interest in learning more about research at March of Dimes. March of Dimes is a 501c3 charitable organization founded in 1938. Its mission is to end preventable preterm birth and improve the lives of all moms and babies so that everyone has a strong and healthy start. Research is one component of our work and the focus of Modcast. If you'd like to learn more about the other areas we work in and take the next step and get involved, find us at marchofdimes.org, on your social media venue of choice, or like, follow, and subscribe to this podcast. We can't do this without your support. Consider getting involved with your local March of Dimes group, joining us at a March for Babies event, or donating to the cause. I'm Alessia Plahee. See you next time.